Chapter 2.
It's Tom?
Yeah, beginning of chapter 2. Okay. And the end of chapter 1, we run this idea, the concept that the letters are channels. And God said, let there be whatever. The word like rakia is resh kuf yud aleph. And that those four letters are four channels for the godliness to come through.
Right.
And that with the utterance, the 10 utterances, that was really 10 potentials. The godliness was too great to be manifest anything at that point. And what had to happen is it had to go through a creation process whereby there was a diminution of the godliness so that the final resultant could appear, meaning us. Now, and he said that the godliness has to be constantly involved with the creation, keeping it in existence. We gave the example of a rock flying in the air. As long as the energy, which is overcoming the gravitational pull, is stronger than the gravitational pull, the rock is up in the air. Once that energy dissipates, the rock flies back down to where it came from. Back to earth and exists on the ground as though it had never been thrown before. So with us also is the world is a creation ex nihilo, something from nothing, and it requires a constant involvement of Hashem keeping the world a something. He's going to talk about more of this in chapter 3. But in chapter 2, I don't know if you would call it a side point or a tangent even, but he at this point attacks the fallacies of Aristotelian logic.
Okay.
And
same lines as the Rambam, and more
that much simpler and okay. In much more condensed space. I mean, Marty Tavukim, there's chapters and chapters and chapters, but here it's just very simple. So he says, the Khan, Chuvas Haminim. Here we have an answer to the heretics. Heretics here means the Greek philosophers.
That's Aristotle.
Yes, Aristotelians. Yes. Vigile Shurish Ta'usam. And the revelation of the source of their mistake, HaKreifrim B'Hashgacha Pratis. They deny in divine involvement. Now, later on, in the middle of chapter 7, I just opened up right to the page, on the bottom of page 314, he says, this is in chapter 7, talks about our perspective of creation, page 314.
No?
You're in 406 over here. You're in the wrong. Hello.
Yes, sir.
That hello. Would make a whole lot of difference.
Yeah. Get on the page there. We're in Shariyat V'Amunah. We're on page 290-289 is where we are.
Sheesh.
Yes. So on page 314, he says, "V'hine mekanyeh shlahavin shkagus mixas chachamim." Here we'll understand the error that some chachamim made. B'inyani Hashem b'kayfer ba'adam sheshana v'toya b'inyanim kisvi arizal. That they made a mistake in the translation of the arizal and therefore wound up denying in hashgacha pratis. This is talking about in chapter 7. Is talking about the Vilna Gaon, and we'll get here when we talk to over here.
Okay.
Here it says, you see, there's a difference in how he approaches them. Here he says, you have the mistake of the heretics. Here he calls it a shkagai, meaning he didn't know. He says it very, very, with lots of derech eretz.
Yes.
Because the Vilna Gaon wrote more books on Kabbalah than he did on Gemara.
Maybe.
Most people don't know that. And he held himself to be an expert in Kabbalah, and in the Alter Rebbe, in one line, shows that what was his big mistake is that he didn't learn with a teacher, because the word Kabbalah would be translated colloquially as tradition. Coming from the word kabel means to receive. You have to have a teacher
to receive
the Kabbalah. Now, who's going to teach? The Vilna Gaon has already been through Shas, who knows how many times, probably twice a day. How many times he went through Shas? So who's going to teach the Vilna Gaon? Who's going to tell the Vilna Gaon, oh, by the way, I'm sorry, you're wrong? No one's going to...
Even if they thought so, it wouldn't
matter. That's right. Someone's going to stand up to him. So, and he himself, you know, he knows how to read Hebrew. If he can sit down and figure out a piece of Gemara, Shulchan Aruch, these things, he can take out a book that's written by some Kabbalist in the 1300s or the 1500s translate that. But he made a mistake in translation because Hebrew, especially when you're talking about in Kabbalah, the concepts are so refined that if you don't translate it correctly, you could get kfira mamish, absolute denial in Hashem's existence. And the things that you could come up with, you could come up with a Kabbalah of Madonna Lahavdil, which isn't Kabbalah at all.
Perfect.
Okay? Her teacher, quote unquote, she had a teacher. The only thing is the teacher was teaching her wrong. Okay, Berg knows less about Kabbalah than your three-year-old does.
Empty hands on empty heads.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So it's good marketing, and so Berg now has $60 million in real estate holdings around the world. You know, thank you very much.
For all the
it's all got to do with
for
packaging.
All the good it's doing. Him.
All the packaging that it's got him. You know, so I hope he's happy.
Yeah, for all the good it's doing.
Anyway, so. I also need a sugar mama. That was kind of cute. $60 million worth of holdings. I don't want all my holdings around the world, though. Anyway, if anybody out on there listening to RabbiFinman.com happens to have a spare $1 million, you can just hit the donate button on the same page. Okay. PayPal would accept $1 million. It's just that they would take $300,000 for themselves. So
tax deductible this year.
Send it to me in a check, please. Yes. Anyway,
or come by with cash. It's okay.
Anyway, let's not be glib. So, but here he's talking about Aristotle, and unfortunately, what happened because of Aristotle is Aristotle is recognized as the father of modern philosophy. And Christian philosophy is based, Christian theology is very much based on Aristotle. The writings of Aristotle. Mm-hmm. And so if he made a mistake, which is a very basis of the philosophy, so anything built upon that is going to be a total mess. Like, for example, if your foundation is built on sand, your building is not really going to do too well. Okay, so this is what he says over here. He says, he denies the idea of Ashgacha Pratis. There's no such thing as divine intervention. And nor do they acknowledge that any of the miracles that happened in the Torah. There are people who go out of their way based on this philosophy to explain how it could be that all these things happen naturally.
Yes.
And they come up with all kinds of good explanations. Mm-hmm. Okay, Hanukkah was no big deal. If you have an oil which is a bit thicker, or a wick that's a bit thicker, and it's a different type of material, and it wicks up the oil much slower, so it'll burn for 8 days. That's how we could explain it.
Surely.
And even Kriyas Yamsuf, there's a book written in the 50s by a Russian scientist by the name of Velikovsky. I think he called it the Way of the Worlds or War of the Worlds or something like that.
Daniel Velikovsky. I have it.
You have it, okay.
I have it, yes.
And he writes over there that the reason why there was a splitting of this Red Sea is because Venus was unnaturally close to Earth.
Yes.
And it caused a gravitational pull.
Yes.
And it just so happened to do that pulling right at the time
when they needed it.
The Jewish people were crossing, and it happened to unpull when the Egyptians started to cross.
Yes.
Okay, so
it's
this
pulling
is...
pulling my leg.
Yeah, this is like, I have an easier time thinking that some super phenomenal being split the sea rather than saying that Venus pulled on it.
But they can't do the astronomical calculations at all.
I don't think it would be possible.
Or the volcano at Horus Sinai that made all the signs.
Right, he also maintained that the manna that fell from heaven was pieces of Venus, but that would be like physically impossible.
Sulfuric acid. Well,
that would be physically impossible, so.
And that the fire and ice was frozen methane from a meteor.
Right, exactly. So this is all stuff, you know, and it only fell specifically on the non-Jewish houses, not on the Jewish ones.
Right.
So this is all, you know. People go out of their way. They have to. They want to say that there's a miracle's not a miracle, which is a very simple answer as to why there are no miracles of biblical proportion today. You don't have suns stopping in the sky for 12 hours. You don't have seas splitting. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't have manna falling from heaven like you wake up in the morning and your food is sitting on your front lawn, unless you're a cow. The
been called a jackass.
But the thing is though, the miracles are not so written up. They're not so you can't take a snapshot of it, but the miracles are still happening.
Sure they are. You bet they are.
And if you want to know about manna from heaven, so you don't even have to open up your front door to get your food in the morning, do you? It's sitting right on the pantry.
That's exactly.
It's just, you know, because it says, we may have said this before, that there were different, the people got manna for 40 years in the desert in different ways. Righteous people opened up the flap of their tent and there was fresh baked manna sitting at the door of their tent.
Wow. Right.
The average Joe, he went out into the field and he picked up a fresh baked loaf of manna.
Right.
The wicked people had to go further out and they got some raw material and they had to mix it with water and pound it, grind it into a meal and mix it together and bake it.
Right.
And then they had their manna. And in all instances, the manna tasted like whatever you wanted it to taste like.
Right.
So what happens now is you go to work for 8 hours a day or so. And after the end of a certain period, so some corporation puts a number into your number. And then you go to a store and you take some number out of your number and you put it into some store's number. And you come home with all the stuff and you unpack it and you put it on the shelf. And then somebody puts it into a pot and cooks it. And guess what? It tastes like whatever you want it to taste like, because that's what you made. So the manna is still coming. It's just that we have to look a little little harder at it to see that it's still manna from heaven.
Don't ever look too hard.
And if you're wondering about all of the what about the miracles of biblical proportion, if you've ever driven on the lodge during rush hour, the fact that you make it to work and back is an indication that there is divine presence actively involved in every move that we make.
Yeah, the midshipman would have survived it.
Yes.
I drive home on the lodge and down on 75.
Yeah, so you know, so I specifically say the lodge because there's something called the centurions on the lodge. Those are the people who like to go 100 miles an hour.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, thank you very much.
Through the Wyoming curve.
Yes, exactly. Right into the sun. Okay. So there's always a way, and Hashem makes it such not to ever corner us that we will not have free choice to say, oh yeah, absolutely, there's no other way to explain this other than the fact that it was a miracle. Hashem won't do that to us. Hashem always gives us Hashem always gives himself an out,
right,
so that someone could say, nah, it wasn't a miracle.
But if you want to see it.
If you want to look at it as a miracle, you can look at it as a miracle. You know, people are reminded today Lubavitchers have always done the low road when it came to talking about the miracles that the Lubavitcher Rebbe's wrought.
Mm.
Because in Lubavitch, it wasn't our thing to talk about miracles.
Right.
You know, there's a famous story. This is a side story from the story.
Mm.
That there was a chassid by the name of Shmuel Gerari, who was a very wealthy businessman. He was traveling on a train from point A to point B. This will put you around like the early 1900s. Mm. And there's some other chassidim in the train with him, and they're talking. They're trying to impress what their Rebbe was able to do, the miracles that they did. And he's sitting there, he's doing his thing. So they said, Shmuel, no, tell us a moifus, tell us a wonder from the Lubavitcher. At that time, we'd been the Rebbe Rashab. So he said, I once went to the Rebbe with a business proposal that I could make a lot of money. And I asked the Rebbe his advice, and the Rebbe told me to invest heavily. I went, yaw, yaw. And he said, I lost my pants. So he said, where's the maifus? Where's the wonder? So he says, the wonder is that I'm still a chassid of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. That's the wonder. Because with us, with Lubavitch, our connection to the Rebbe is not because of anything that the Rebbe did for us or anything, you know, in that type of a thing. It was more of a personal thing. It was more like essence to essence. But there was, for example, there was a story that when Arik Sharon came to visit the Rebbe, at that point he was, I think, the what do they call it, the Minister of Defense.
I think it was in the mid-70s.
Yeah, in the mid-70s. And the Rebbe asked him, he came to Yechidus, and it was like on a Tuesday, and the Rebbe said to him, when are you going back? He said, tomorrow on the 2 o'clock plane. So the Rebbe said, take the 7 o'clock plane. So he took his advice. The 2 o'clock plane was the only plane that was ever hijacked, the LL plane that was ever hijacked, and it was taken to Algiers. And they believe that the reason why it was hijacked is because his name was on the roster over there. So now someone went back to the Lubavitcher Rebbe and said, you have clairvoyance over here. You're a prophet. You knew that he shouldn't take the 2 o'clock. And the Rebbe poo-pooed it and said, listen, he asked that he's in Manhattan and he's got things to do. And he's not going to be able, he's going to have to rush if he's going to. So I told him, listen, why make your life so awful, topsy-turvy to get to the airport at 2 o'clock? Just take life easier, make it, you know, go at 7 o'clock. You could go, you know, it's only 5 hours difference.
Possible.
Yeah, no, that's the way he described what happened. Okay, so, but other people, you know, so, was it clairvoyance? We'll never know. Was it, you know?
Hashem changed the time of hijacking. Maybe so they could hijack it.
Whatever it was. If you want to look for an out, you can look for an out. If you want to look for an in, you could look for an in. It's always, Hashem gives us that choice. So the Aristotelians were naturalists. We know this because the Greeks generally did not believe in the concept of holiness at all. All of the decrees, we have Hanukkah, the whole thing over there. What was it? Lahashkicham Torisecha, Lahavir Mechukei Ritzaynecha, to get you to forget the Torah and stop doing mitzvahs. They weren't interested in killing Jews.
They were interested in killing
Torah. Judaism.
Yeah.
And what part of Judaism? Not the Bible.
No.
I had a guy on my show this last week who was a very good interview. And he wrote a book on the philosophy. The Bible is the philosophy of the Hebrew Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Something to that extent is the name of the title. And I talked to him about it. So I said to him, so what influence did the Hebrew Bible have on, say, Greek philosophy? And he said, we have no recorded anything because the Greeks never gave any credence or credulity to the Jews anyway. But you had the beginning, early Greek philosophers were the same time as Yeshaya, Yirmiyah.
Mm-hmm.
And there was trade going back and forth. And the prophecies of these people of Yirmiyah, which were written down, were carried to Greece.
To Yirmiyahu who met with Plato after the base first destruction.
Could very well
be.
Yeah, he said another name of a philosopher. I don't remember. His name began with a B, like Batavius or something like that. That would have been like, that sounds too Latin. That's a Latin ending.
It wasn't Aristotle.
Aristotle was way later. Because Aristotle was a teacher of Alexander the Great.
Right.
And Alexander the Great was 100 years before the story of Hanukkah,
yeah,
put you in the middle.
About
so you're talking in Yirmiyah, you're talking 200 years before that.
Right.
And that's when the early Greek philosophers were starting to come up. And so he said there was trade back and forth, and they for sure had to have it, but the Greeks are not going to give credulity to some Jews. So Shatayim Bidyamainim Hakaizav, they make a mistake with their false imaginations. Shemidami Maisa Hashem Oisa Shemayim Vaoritz Lamaisa Enershatach Bulosov. They compare man and all the tricks that man does in what we call a creation. Look what I've created to what we call a creation of a something from nothing.
Right.
And basically he puts it down into is we don't create, we just form. We kind of push things around.
Right.
We don't create. Create means to take nothing and make it into something. That we don't do. And he says this, Kikasha Yatzel Sarev Kli, when it is that you have a smith, like a silversmith, that makes a cup. Once the cup is made, you don't have to have the smith standing there holding it to keep it in existence.
Right.
He could take it, he could put it on the shelf, it could stay there for who knows how long. The cup no longer needs the smith.
Right.
Even though the smith puts it down and he goes to the marketplace, he's not even anywhere around in reasonable proximity to the cup. Hakli kayim between us of its elmo mamish kasher yatsam yedei atzarf. So the cup never loses its form or its image as it was made. It's still this. It'll come back 2 hours later, and you know what? The cup will look exactly the same.
Right.
So that's what that's the paradigm that Aristotle uses in creation theory. Kach midamim hasichlim ha'el, so too, these fools. It's a very strong word. That's about as strong a word you're going to get out of the Alter Rebbe, is a kesil. Okay? These imbeciles. Midamim elo ha'maisa shemayim va'aretz. They compare what a person does to the way Hashem made heaven and earth. But they should open up their eyes and they should see that there's a whole nother world between what people do. That's just that is just yesh mi yesh. It's a something out of a something else. You take a silver ingot and you melt it down, or you hammer it down, and you melt it down, you pour it into a mold, and it comes out a cup. Or you take the ingot, and you hammer it, and you smash it into the shape of a cup. Kesef. You take a piece of metal, and you hammer it down from just a simple blob. L'tumunas kli, and you handle that into a cup. And you're comparing that, l'maisa shemayim v'aretz, comparing that to the work of heaven and earth. Shehu yesh ma'ayin, which that is a something from a nothing. And he says a very interesting thing, this is very perplexing, this next line, that the creation of a something from nothing, hu pela gadol yesa mikriyas yamsuf, is much more wondrous than the splitting of the sea. Duh! Creation is more wondrous than splitting the sea? What is he thinking? He wants to impress us. How am I going to impress you that this great thing is greater than this little thing? If we would come up with something which is even more impressive and say, oh, it's even more impressive than that. So what is the Alter Rebbe's intention by saying that creation, a something of nothing, is even greater than taking the water and splitting it in two?
We take the creation for granted.
No. There are three types of miracles, and they're analogized by three holidays: Purim, Hanukkah, and Shvi Yishal Pesach.
Right.
Purim, what was the whole mice of it? There was a miracle. There was a threat of annihilation. All the Jews are going to kill Rahman al-Islam in one day. And Hashem made a miracle, true. And it was that the Jews didn't get killed, but their enemies got overthrown.
Right.
Okay? When it came time to canonize the book of Esther and incorporate it into the Bible, the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah said, what are you talking about? What miracle? Where miracle? You're the queen. You're the prime minister. You did lobbying the right way at the right time. Your book that you write doesn't even have Hashem's name in it. Not once is there any mention of Hashem. This is no miracle. That's the flack that they got from the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. But if you're the queen and Uncle Mordechai is the prime minister, things kind of get done.
Yeah.
And when they canonized the book of Esther, the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah did it on condition that this is absolutely the last book in the Bible, unless there comes a Beis Din which is of equal number and equal stature as the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, which is 120 people. And you have guys like Esther and Daniel and Mordechai and Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah and Nehemiah and etc. So that's never going to happen again in that fast. And so the book of Esther closes it. That's why there's no book of Maccabees in our Bible. Because it happened afterwards. Okay, so it's a natural thing, but was it a miracle? Yes, it was for sure 100% a miracle.
120%.
What's the proof given in the Gemara? Is because it says, "Vayomer Haman b'libay mimachas yachvatz amalach l'chvayd yaisim emeni." And Haman said in his heart, Haman said to himself, who would the king desire to honor any person greater than me? So how do we know what Haman was thinking in his heart?
No.
We don't. It's only because the book was written with Ruach HaKodesh.
Okay.
No, and God didn't say anything to anybody, because if they did, then it would be in the prophets, not in the writings.
Right.
But it's enough to convince us that it was indeed a miracle. So you have miracles that are happening, like we said before, that occur that are totally, completely can be explained naturally. You didn't get into an accident on the lodge today because you weren't texting, you were paying attention, everybody else happened to be paying attention, and voila. And it was all divine providence, and it was miraculous anyway. Then you have the miracle of Hanukkah. What happened with the miracle of Hanukkah? Would it be, for example, you're a Maccabee, and you're holed up in a cave, and you didn't hear that the victory was over, and you're in the base of Mikdash until like the third day. Someone comes and says, oh, whatever happened to what's his name? Are you still up in the cave? Oh, come, go send somebody, go get him. Okay, so the time you come down, it's like the third day of Hanukkah. They tell you, could you please go into the base of Mikdash and take care of the Keteris today? It's your turn. Okay? So he goes in, and he happens to notice that the menorah is lit. Would that attract any attention, anything unusual to him? To you, this Kohen?
No.
Why?
Because it's lit every day anyway.
It's lit every day.
The last time it was supposed to be lit.
It was lit.
It's lit every day. Anyway.
Was it burning? It's burning oil. If it would be that they went into the base of Mikdash, and the Greeks did such a job that they defiled all the oil, and all they could find was one small jar of vinegar. And they said, no, like Rabbi Hanina ben Dosa, the one who said that oil can light will say that vinegar could light. And they put it into the menorah, they put a wick in, and it lights. Now you got, this is a hoo-ha miracle. Because vinegar doesn't burn. What did Hashem do? For Hanukkah, all that Hashem did was to stretch the laws of nature. Did we talk about this recently?
Mm-mm.
No? That's because oil burns. It burns at a certain pace with a certain thickness of a certain wick. And he made it such that it should burn 8 times as slow, or 1/8 as fast. So it was miraculous. And then there's even discussion in the Gemara as to how exactly was this miracle perpetrated. There's one opinion that says that the oil burned 1/8 of the time that it was supposed to burn. Every day it burned 1/8 as much. There's another opinion that said that no, it burnt the whole way down, and miraculously the cup filled up again. There's another opinion that said that they knew they were only going to have it for 8 days, so they filled up the cups only 1/8 of the way. There's another opinion that says they filled it out the whole way, they dumped all the oil in, and that the jug miraculously filled up. So there's different ways of understanding, well, how did the miracle happen? Mm-hmm. But when you're still talking about it, when all push comes to shove, we're still talking about oil burning, and oil burns.
Mm-hmm.
Comes along now, Shvi Shel Pesach, which commemorates Kriyas Yamsuf, the splitting of the sea. And what happened there? Hashem changed the nature of water. Unlike, say, when the Jews crossed the Yarden. In the story of Joshua, when the Jews crossed over the Jordan River, what happened? The Kohanim were carrying the Aron HaKodesh, and as soon as they put their feet into the water that was downstream from them kept flowing. The water that was upstream was held up by an invisible dam, but it kept on flowing. It's not like it congealed and stayed in that place over there. It kept flowing, such by the time that the last Jew crossed the Yarden, the water was about 300 miles high and could be seen by the Canaanites that were living in the Mediterranean. And they all knew, oh, that's the water of the Jordan up there. Okay, but it was still water. And as soon as they left, as soon as the last one crossed and they took the ark out, what happened? The water started flowing properly again. Hashem took away the force field that was holding it back, and it started flowing again. And he did it in such a nice way.
Down.
It's like it didn't crash down 300 miles worth of water all at once. It came down very nicely, thank you very much. So it's not to cause any damage.
Now that's what the watch.
The watch is coming down. I think it kind of came out from the bottom.
Well,
that's
sure.
what I would think.
I'm sure.
Rather than coming off the top and falling down, I think it kind of came from the bottom and just kind of like evened itself out.
Either way.
That's not what happened, though, at Kriyas Yamsuf. At Kriyas Yamsuf, the nature of water changed from being a flowing aqueous solution to a polarized, congealed, split entity. And it was such that all the water of the world split, except for the Nile, and that's because Moshiach's got to do that, and it's only to give us free choice to say, oh, it must not have been Hashem. But that's what the nature, it wasn't that Hashem sort of like stuck something in there and just like held the water back. No, the nature of water changed. And indeed it says in one of the Medrashim, in Bereishis, by the third day, on the second day, when Hashem split the water, and he made the upper water and the lower water, and the lower water started complaining. So Hashem said, made all kinds of conditions with the lower water, and he said that, oh, by the way, after it all done, and the water or the lower water was happy, he said, oh, by the way, at some time in the future, the Jews are going to want to cross the Reed Sea, and you're going to have to change, your nature is going to have to be changed so as to facilitate their crossing, and you're not going to object, okay? And he said, okay, he says, as God said, if you would object, I would cease to create water. I'd find another way of doing it. So the water said, okay, fine, split me for the 12 hours. Which meant that the nature of water changed. And if you think that's any type of a big deal, try changing your nature for 12 hours. Let me know how that goes.
Try changing it for 12 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. Akiva, for the next 12 hours, I want you to become a hothead.
Yeah.
Okay? I want you to just get angry at everything.
Perfect.
Right.
That's probably not too difficult. I'm not a nice guy.
Yeah, okay. I won't share your secret.
Yeah, okay. Fine.
Yeah, okay. Because he explains over here. How did it happen? Well, there's Mashal. Shehayelach Hashem es hayam baruch kodem azeh kol halayla. How's it explained? There's another explanation that I saw. That it says quite clearly there was a strong east wind blowing. It was, for all intents and purposes, you could call it the expression, the perfect storm.
Mm.
The air pressure was just the right, the barometric pressure was just low enough,
yes.
The wind was blowing just at the right angle, there was a certain thing going on with the tides.
Yes, it was.
It was a specific low tide,
yes.
And it goes into the whole this thing over there and explains naturally, and that's what happened, bada bing, bada boom. The sea split.
Well, you got 3 million. Sea, it's only like 4 feet deep.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, the whole thing wasn't very deep. Yeah.
And you got 3 million Jews to cross in a wind like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Okay, it was a crosswind.
It was.
Yeah. And they went into tunnels
the
anyway.
The wind was ankle high anyway. So.
Yeah. A wind that could do that would blow them
through this salt marsh that was like
yeah.
Right. Well, they went. The water acted as a tunnel. Actually, they were surrounded on three sides by water.
Yes.
So they were protected from everything out there. You know. So another thing. So, it was the strong east wind that caused it to blow, and as long as Moshe was standing there at the edge of the sea with his outstretched arm holding his staff, the wind blew and the sea stayed split. And as soon as he brought it down, the whole thing went back to the way it was. Vayivko hamayim v'nitzvu kamayneid v'kachayma. And the water happened because of this constant involvement of the east wind. The water stood up like a wall in a polarized fashion. If Hashem would stop blowing the wind, which is eventually what would happen, so the water would return and start flowing back in the way like it was by its nature. And for sure, without a doubt, it wouldn't stand up with like a wall. So we're using this as a saying that what? Why does it say that that creation is greater than Kriyas Yamsuf? Because in Kriyas Yamsuf there had to be a constant energy changing the nature of water. And creation is even greater than that because you're changing the nature of nothing. and you're making the nothing to behave like a something. That's greater even than changing flowing water into standing up like a wall. Even though it is that this the natural flowing of water is also a property of creation. Because you see, for example, stones. You could pile stones on top of each other and make a wall, and you're not going to need a strong east wind keeping it up. The nature of stones is such that if you stack them the right way, you get yourself a wall. Water, however, doesn't behave like that. As much as you might want to stack water, it's not working. How much more so it is when you're talking about a creation of a something from nothing. That's higher than nature because that establishes nature. There is no nature before creation. Because what's there to be natural?
Right.
To say that the nature of
nature is a creation.
To say that the nature of nothing is incorrect. Because nothing has no nature.
Right.
It's before nature.
Before nature.
Nature, nature is an expression of the creation.
Right.
The Hiflu Upele Yesim Akrius Yamsiv. This keeping this thing into existence is much more awesome than the splitting of the sea. Allah has come of a comment, and how much more so? Be he stalkus koyach abayram in a nivra chasashon. Would it be that if it was that the Creator removed his power of creation, chasashon, from the creature, what would happen? Yashiv hanivra la'ayin ve'ef is mamish. This creature would go back to absolute nothing.
Nothingness.
Right. And he emphasized, I think we mentioned this before. In Shalichud B'munah, it happens very often that he has this expression, La'ayin ve'efes mamish. I think there's one or two places where he says, La'ayin ve'efes ha'muchlat mamish. Puts that in there, the extra word muchlat, which means totally removed. So this expression, La'ayin ve'efes, nothing and more nothing, mamish, refers to the worlds of creation, formation, and action. That the thing wouldn't even exist in a world of creation. If Hashem decided to stop creating this thing, the whole concept of its existence
would be gone.
Any trace of its existence.
Like it never, you know, we have no idea if Hashem has done this before. If Hashem says, you know, that species, I just don't like it.
He could have done it last night for that matter.
He could be doing it right now. Okay? Because as soon as Hashem does it, the species never existed. We don't have any recollection of it.
Exactly.
It never existed.
Exactly.
So tomorrow they could start digging up things 100 times bigger than dinosaurs, and he could have created yesterday, and it could appear like they're a billion
Correct.
Years old.
Of course.
Okay, so if Hashem would stop creating the world, it would stop existing, and it would be absolute nothing. This is a very prominent expression throughout the deeper, the deeper Maimarim of Chassidus is Keach HaPoel Benifal. There's a whole section in Thamach Vav. It's like a very famous book of discourses from the Rebbe Rishab, said in the year 1906 and further. And he discusses this idea of Keach HaPoel Benifal. You have to have the power of the effector in the affected. And it is this power of the effector which is determining what this affected thing is.
Yeah.
Why is it that you see with your eyes? It's because of the power of sight, which is enclosed in them. The same thing with all the rest of your body parts. So every entity, every creature, has to have this constant influx of godliness at all times. L'achiyos l'karma v'hein hein b'chinas oisiyas Hadibur Maisara Maimaras Shabaham Nivro Nivro. And what is this power that is creating us? It happens to be when God said, for example, Vayehi Akiva. Vahaya Akiva. Hashem said, let there be an Akiva, and there was an Akiva. Okay, the Akiva is, what is Akiva? Akiva is the benefit and byproduct of the combination of the channels which manifest themselves as an ayin, a kuf, a vav, a beis, and an alf. In that order directly. Mm-hmm. Okay, because if you would mix up the letters, mix up the channels, do it with something like aleph, kuf, vav, beis, ayin, which means I will fix or set. So then you get a whole different thing. You don't get an akiva out of that. That's not what an akiva is.
Get something else.
Well, it must be because you fix a lot of things. Okay, so it must be something there. All the permutations of your name have some kind of relationship and relevance to you.
Okay.
So, about the way in which Hashem enlivens the world, we have a verse which we say in davening every day, you enliven everything. Don't read it that you enliven everything, but read it that you make everything come into existence. Now there is a rule which is brought down by the Shalach HaKadosh. That when it says Al Tikra, you ever come across that expression, Michael? Al Tikra, don't read it this way, read it that way. Comes into the Gemara a zillion times.
Yeah.
Okay. He says, what they're telling you is not to discount the first interpretation, but you have an additional interpretation. The first one is still valid. The second one adds something to it. And that's for sure when it says, Va'ata mechaya es kulam, you enliven everything. And it says, Al tikra mechaya ela mahava. Don't read it mechaya ela, that which means enliven everything. Read it mahava, that brings everything into existence. Two different things. One refers to the Ora Mamali, the other one refers to the Ora Soviv. And if you recall from back in the chapters, in the 50s, in the Sharia, and in the Tanya, which we didn't learn all that long ago, that or panimi, or the mamali kol ami, means the godliness which is revealed within us, and we could see that. And the or sovev is the higher level of godliness which is within us, but was not revealed. We don't see how it only affects us in a superficial manner. So when he says, don't read it, mechaya ela mahava, both things are going on. Hashem is enlivening the world, and Hashem is bringing the world into existence. What's the difference between enlivened and existence? If something wasn't enlivened, it would be dead. If something wasn't in existence, it wouldn't be there.
Wouldn't be at all, right?
Big difference between dead and not in existence.
Dead things exist.
Exactly.
Exactly, right.
Elamah, the Haina Yeshma Ayin. That means a something from nothing. Who is it that is bringing about this creation of a something from nothing? Is Ata Machayas Kulam. You are enlivening everything. Va'ata Hubuchinas Oisiyas Ma'alavatov. What's Ata? Ata is Aleph to Tuf, all the letters of the alphabet, is what's enlivening the world. The hey, but Ata has a hey at the end. This refers to the five articulates of speech, which are the lips, teeth, tongue, palate, and throat, by which you say all the specific letters, which in proper combination makes you understood. So it says you have a similar thing, quote unquote, for Hashem. That Hashem has the hey articulus, which are referred to elsewhere as the hey gavurois. I don't know if you've ever heard of that expression, the five severities, which refers to the severity, the level of severity of keser, the level of severity of das, the severity of teferis, the severity of yisoid, and the severity of malchus. So there are five spheres there. It's the middle road. And the five gevuras are what we call the five gevuras of Atzilus. Okay, so he says, Hashem doesn't have articulus. Hashem doesn't have a mouth, teeth, tongue, etc. The pasuk is rife with the words every time Hashem speaks. It says Hashem spoke, Hashem said. That's, for example, how is it that it's manifest, at least as in the latter years, is in words that the prophets were able to convey. Did the prophets hear words? The answer is no, they did not.
No.
What they felt was an influence. Mm-hmm. And the influence affected their intelligence. And they were able, once they come down, to interpret what it was that they were thinking, and then be able to articulate it and say, this is what Hashem told me.
Right.
Okay, even though you're asking, well, did you actually hear it? No, I never heard it, but when I woke up, there it was.
Yeah. Unless it was small or Moshe.
The only one who could hear it was Moshe.
Right.
He's the only one who heard God.
Well, I think Shmuel's the one who didn't have to be asleep, but in the middle, he heard.
He didn't get it straight, though. It came like when God said to him, hey, Shmuel, he like ran over to Eli and said, what do you want? So, you know, if he would have been straight, he would have said, oh, God. Quite literally. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
And then imagine Shmuel when he said, point out Shaul and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
He's not in a trance. He's not in tone.
So it makes you wonder how Abraham got it.
He merited it. That's after Ethan.
Yeah, he got it different. He also got it different.
Yeah, we can see Shmuel the first time he's like 8 years old. He gets his revelation of God. He goes, OMG.
Yeah, I doubt it.
I this is it. I got it. You know, he puts it on Facebook, gets the picture out there. OMG.
No, I'm sorry.
That what's prophecy is a revelation of combinations of the 22 supernal letters to the prophet. And the godly flow or influence now was able to affect their intellect, their comprehension, with the appearance of their prophecies, so they can say, you know, I just had this prophecy thing going on over there. And you don't think that there weren't crazies back then saying, God told me the world's coming to an end. There were plenty of Mishigoyim then also.
Oh, sure.
Okay, but a prophet wasn't a prophet until he proved that he was a prophet.
Yeah. They rocked him to sleep.
Yeah, Like, tell me, please, if in your test, which numbers to play for the next lottery. And also the prophets, when they're prophesizing, so you have this expression of thought, the expression of speech that they're saying. And it says, Ruach Hashem Diber Bi, the Spirit of God speaks within me. Umalsay Alashani, and His words are on my tongue. Kamoshikas of Arizal Vishara Navu, as Arizal writes, as about how this whole prophecy thing goes on. I'm not going to go into it now. Okay, Ein Zehu Bihi Flamshus HaOisi is Bevrayim, and so too it is. This is the way it is. How the 22 letters are enclosed to enliven every creature. As it says, by the speech of Hashem were the heavens created, and the breath of His mouth all of their hosts. But the way that it happens is when God said, let there be a firmament, nothing happened. You had to first have a whole chain reaction. A very big one, an infinite one, as a matter of fact. And one which is also qualitatively diminishing of the godliness. Until it comes down into this physical world of action. Which is not the case with the prophets. The prophets, it didn't come down so low. It just only went from Atzilus into Bria, which is not Shum Chain. But
just
for the godliness to come down here and be enclosed into our world and for us to utilize it means that it came from a much higher place, a much higher source than even Chochmah of Atzilus. To be continued.